behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined, as always, today by our super producer, Dylan Fagan, and we'll give him a nickname toward the end. We'd also like to introduce our new super producer, Tristan McNeil.
Tristan. Shiftin' Tristan.
Shiftin' Tristan, that rhymes.
It works. Yeah, you know? Maybe. We'll see. But it doesn't really flow with today's topic.
It doesn't really flow with today's topic. It just sort of floats out there in the aether, you know, unsurveilled by us. But watching. What am I doing with this terrible segue?
That's not terrible.
That was really bad, Scott.
So.
I'm introducing an idea that we've talked about a little bit in the past, but never really drilled into, and that is the concept of surveillance blimps.
Yeah, now we've had a couple of episodes in the past that have dealt with some related topics, I suppose. Mm-hmm. If you want to look back at Car Stuff episodes from, going back 6 years now. So in August of 2011, we had the rise and fall of airships, which we went pretty in-depth into what they're all about. You know, mm-hmm. And I think in that case, it was more toward passengers, you know, more toward transportation.
Sure, it was a means of transit.
Yeah, and I'm sure we touched on military applications as well. I haven't listened to that whole episode again recently, so don't beat me up too bad on that one if it's not exactly that. But we also had another one that was called, this one is tangentially related, I guess, surveillance vehicles.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
That was back in April of 2016, so that's relatively recent, just a little bit more than a year ago, and that one, I like that one a lot. We got a lot of response from the surveillance vehicles episode because a surprising number of people, that's kind of their day job, you know, when they listen to us. So maybe they're in the car right now operating a surveillance, a stakeout, right? Maybe they're in a stakeout right now listening to this podcast, not watching what's going on around them.
But that's true.
Terrible movie, by the way.
We also talked about, I just want to put in a side note here because this was by far my favorite part of those past episodes. We also talked about the USS Akron and the Macon, which are these, if you haven't heard the episode, did we do this in Rise and Fall of Airships?
Maybe.
They're these blimps that are motherships, and they carry smaller planes, or past tense, they carried smaller planes.
Just to give you a sense of scale, because I just looked this up maybe 20 minutes ago before we walked in here. All right, so it's in a note here. Okay, here it is. A Boeing 747 is about 232 feet long. Now, we all know the Boeing 747. It's a giant plane, the double-decker plane, huge. When you see it at the airport, even among other planes, you think, man, that's a big plane. So 232 feet long. The USS Akron was 785 feet long. That's incredible. That's more than three times the length. Yeah. 3.5 or something like
and
that.
And it carried these things called Sparrowhawks. And Sparrowhawks were these small biplane-looking fighter craft. But when we say small, we mean tiny. And the pilots would unhook from a hook hanging off the bottom of the airship.
Yeah, this looks so scary when it happens. Because there's film of this happening.
Yeah.
And it's scary. It's scary film. But you should check it out for sure. You know, we should point out that this isn't like the birth of surveillance or of blimps or zeppelins used in surveillance, though.
Right.
It goes back to the Civil War.
Yes. Yeah. This is a little known part of Civil War history: is the use of balloons for reconnaissance.
Now, check me if I'm wrong, Ben. Is that the first application of military application that you've heard of, or were there previous versions of it? I'm unaware of anything before the Civil War.
It's a little bit murky because after a certain point, that technology, right, the idea of creating a balloon that can carry a person or a thing, that technology is pretty old, and we can figure out places in time and space where someone came up with the idea, but it's a little bit difficult to conclusively say someone came up with it first.
Well, I didn't mean to put you on the spot at all. I mean, by any means, but the first real military application that I could come up with was the Civil War, and it was something called the Union Army Balloon Corps.
Uh-huh.
And they had 7 balloons. I think they used 6 of them eventually, but strictly reconnaissance. And it's strange to think about this, but this is more like a traditional hot air balloon shape, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Often made of silk. I think there were other materials that were used as well. Primarily or originally originally just from the Union Army, and then later the Confederate Army had to kind of counteract this with their own balloon corps, but it didn't really go so well. They had some real problems with their balloon applications, I guess, mm-hmm. maybe the way they used them. It's strange to think, though, that you could just float in this. Now, it was a tethered balloon, typically. There was a free flight version of this, and there's also a tethered balloon version of this, where mm-hmm. They could just reel it back in. But it's strange to think that they were unreachable by by the munitions that were used by the other side.
By the armaments of the time.
Yeah, it's strange. So the way that they would the only way they could really do this was to dig a trench behind a cannon and angle it up in order to hopefully get the right trajectory to hit this balloon, but it was going to appear and then disappear and then reappear somewhere else. So there's no way to really consistently set up for, taking down this reconnaissance balloon. And that's what it was primarily used for, is reconnaissance. And I think there was a later version that would allow them to, it was a heavier, bigger balloon, but it allowed them to take a telegraph machine up, so they could send down Morse code of what they were seeing on the battlefield.
Oh, wow.
Because prior to that, they were using flags. Is kind of like a system of
semaphore system.
Yeah, semaphore system. That's what it's called. And they would send down the message of what they're seeing on the uh-huh. battlefield. And that's not a great way to do it, but it's the best that they had at the time.
And it's still better than people on the ground attempting to figure stuff out.
Well, yeah, because you're getting this incredible vantage point that no one on your side or the opposing side at the time had. And you can see some amazing photos of these balloons, I guess you call them what were the name of them? There's a certain name for it. I think one was Intrepid that uh-huh. had written on the side of it. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the most famous one, I think, that you see. It was the guy that created this. I think his name was Lowe, and that was his favorite balloon to use. So that's often the one you'll see in the Civil War photos.
So what you'll probably hear about, and I know I matrix dodged the question about the first balloon stuff, what you'll probably hear this stuff traced back to would be France in 1783. However, we don't have to spend much time on this because we have a different show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, that's about these sorts of things. However, there are competing theories about inventors independently creating hot air balloon technology in other parts of the world. One of the most controversial theories we heard regarding this pertains to the Nazca lines, which are in the southern hemisphere, right, South America. These gigantic glyphs or rough shapes made out of stone, and these things are thousands and thousands of feet. They're huge. On the ground, it doesn't appear that they are actually a thing, except for a couple weird lines of stones. However, Scott, if someone were to be in a hot air balloon, then they would be easily able to say, oh, that's a person, that's a deer, etc.
Sure.
And so one of the controversial theories is that someone in that area, in that civilization, built hot air balloon technology.
Yeah, because how else would they have that vantage point to design such a thing, right?
I mean, right.
That's the whole point, is that you have to be able to see it in order to build it like that without having that understanding from the ground that, and from the ground, again, it looks like nothing.
Yeah, and of course the other theory is, of course, extraterrestrials or some sort. But that's a different show.
But what if it's just natural, Ben? What if it's like, like when you look at the clouds and it's like, oh, that one looks like a clown or an ice cream cone or a bunny or something like that?
Maybe. But
it's not likely.
So we trace the typical explanation you'll see is that we trace this kind of technology back to Paris in 1783.
And then if we want to bring this forward into a couple of other bigger wars, other wars, World War I, World War II, of course they were used during those. And I do think we touched on those in our airship episode.
But
they became more and more sophisticated as time went on. They became to, gradually morph into what we know as like the Zeppelin shape, the blimp shape.
Right, the thermal airship. The big difference between a typical hot air balloon, such as the kind used in the Civil War, and the Goodyear blimp that you might see outside of sports games and such, is that a thermal airship is steerable. It is not at the mercy of errant winds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the big thing that drove this change would be propulsion and the ability to steer the thing. So they had a way to then, drive it through the air and a way to control the height, the altitude. Mm-hmm. So they became much more advanced, and they also began to carry more and more sophisticated equipment, as well as more and more, well, actually, for the first time, they began to carry, you know, means of, well, the armament. They carried, well, ammunitions, or munitions, I should
right,
say.
Right, right. They could carry bombs.
Yeah.
We already talked about, I feel like I already spoiled the coolest part. We already talked about deploying these tiny planes.
Yeah, but you know what? It's maybe the coolest part about those old-time ones, right? And that is interesting.
Right.
And, you know, the thing about the Akron, though, is that it eventually crashed. It never made it to World War II, so it never saw service in World War II, obviously. And there was a pretty significant loss of life. I mean, I think there was like 73 or 76 crew members that were lost off the coast of New Jersey, I think it was, back in 1933. It was prior to World War II, anyway.
Only three survivors.
Yeah, and just there's a pretty detailed account of, you know, what happened that evening. I think it was sent out in a thunderstorm, and there was some kind of there were some problems there, of course.
Yeah.
But anyways, it never made it to that. But there's still some fantastic film of that thing operating, and the idea of flying a plane so close to it and trying to latch a hook underneath and then climbing on a ladder up into a Zeppelin.
No pressure.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh,
it really
we should
is.
Also, we should also talk about, without taking too much from our episode on the rise and fall of airships, we do, of course, need to mention that airships, which were posed at one point to become, due to economy of scale, an affordable and common mode of international transport, because of several disasters that occurred and because of the potential for future disasters, airships fell sharply out of favor across the planet.
And, of course, we have to mention the Hindenburg and the volatile gas that was used in that, of course, you know, the hydrogen, which is no longer the case or no longer necessary for these to use that. It's just not the way that they do it. They realize the danger in that.
Right.
And so, again, we covered this in that one, but to this day, I will still stumble across some stories that, you know, Boeing is experimenting with airships as a form of transportation, you know, like a intercontinental form of transportation. And I just wonder, is that ever going to happen in our lifetime? Are we ever going to see, you know, Boeing creating airships that people are going to want to get into that, you know, little gondola? I'm sure it'll be very luxurious and it'll be, you know, everything that, you know, the best jets are now, only slower.
Right.
And
noticeably slower.
Yeah, and just enormous. I mean, these things are going to be gigantic. If you look at the photos of, you know, what they have, the concepts maybe, the ones that they've proposed, they're huge.
Well, the real problem here is not engineering and it's not capacity. The problem, as everyone knows, is security.
Mm-hmm.
So these things are floating targets. No one has, up to this point, no one has invented a technology that will allow the envelope, essentially the thing that holds the gas,
mm-hmm.
no one has invented something that will allow that envelope to work the way an envelope needs to work, but then also be puncture resistant enough to withstand, let's say, a surface-to-air missile or
mm-hmm.
something.
Yeah.
Which is terrible to talk about, but that's the reason. That's the reason why you don't normally see airships over at Hartsfield Airport O'Hare.
I guess this would also kind of take the place of maybe like a train, you know, like a scenic train ride.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe something like, what's another slow, relatively slow, but you get to see a lot. Oh, the bus,
I
suppose. You know, bus, I guess you get to see a lot of the country. Yeah, but donkey transportation.
Yeah, like
sure.
If you were riding a donkey. People do that.
A pack mule.
So we give you all this preface because, as it turns out, the death of the airship has been somewhat exaggerated, and for several years, a new kind of airship has been on the rise, but quietly, very, very quietly.
Yeah.
And we're going to dive into that directly after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. And, Ben, you kind of teased us here with, you know, there's been this quiet operation of a new sort of airship.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
What have we been missing over the last few years?
So,
if you haven't been paying attention to the headlines, that is.
Right, right, right.
Because there were some headlines.
There were some famous headlines. Well, there's one system that's come out called the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor System, or J-Lens.
Kind of rolls off the tongue, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's poetry.
Very simple. I like J-Lens better.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the street name would be Spy Balloon. So this is just like in the Civil War, this system is tethered, and it's designed to track boats, ground vehicles, cruise missiles, other aircraft, etc. It has four primary components. It's got two aerostats that are tethered, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's got armored mooring stations, radars, and a processing station designed to communicate with these other warfare systems. So this would be not an offensive weapon. This is able to see a lot.
Yeah.
And then communicate with another system.
And this is happening at a place called the Aberdeen Proving Ground, which is northeast of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was built by defense contractor Raytheon. And, again, you mentioned some of the stats of this thing, but it can fly up to 10,000 feet up in the air. So it's a significant
yeah.
height. And at that height, the radar system that it carries is able to see for 340 miles in any direction, which is that's pretty significant. That's a decent coverage. And if you were to, you can imagine if you were to space these appropriately, you'd be able to have some excellent coverage across nationwide if you wanted to, really.
Right. And this program dates back to the mid 60s, but it also is okay, look, here's the thing about the Defense Department. I know, ladies and gentlemen, we know that a lot of you do work in defense or in military-related fields, so you probably know more about this than we do. The thing is, when you're developing these kind of systems, there's definite rate of attrition. Not all of these are going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, into every defense project, a little rain must fall. So These have functioned well, but not without incident. And the incident, the headline that you're referring to, Scott, is one of the first times that a lot of people in the U.S. learned that blimps were still around.
Yeah, because it was just kind of there on the base doing what it does in a quiet manner, right? I mean, unless you were in the program, you didn't really know what was happening. I mean, you probably saw this thing if you were, you know, local, if you were right in the Baltimore area.
I thought it was like everybody who thinks of blimps thinks of the Goodyear blimp, at least here in the U.S.
Well, of course, yeah. And you know what? Honestly, the shape is not that far off from that. I mean, it's a caricaturized version of it. It's a great big, huge white blimp that it looks again cartoonish, maybe in the way it's. I mean, even the fins look like they're inflated. It's a strange looking thing,
it
almost
would
like
be
a
so much fun.
What do you call it? Like a big guppy, maybe something like that. Is that's the design? It's bigger at the front end.
Mm-hmm.
The gondola looks like it's really not a gondola. It's more, you know, that's where the stuff is held.
Yeah,
you know, the electronics and things, but. What you're talking about, Ben, is this incident that happened in October of 2015, and I would bet that people in Maryland and Pennsylvania know all about this because that's when it broke free of its moorings.
Yep.
And drug that tether, and the tether that we're talking about is, what is it made of? It's made of, hang on a second, I'll find it here, but it's a heavy-duty tether,
mm-hmm.
and it drug that thing across two states for, 160 miles.
Yeah.
And it was just out of control. It was like they couldn't stop it. You know, they didn't want to shoot it down because the thing's worth several millions.
Yeah, and it rose to 16,000 feet. They didn't want to shoot it down because it cost like $109 million.
Yeah.
So they had two fighter jets escort it
yeah.
across the state.
Kevlar, that's what it is. These tethers are made of Kevlar. So they're heavy-duty tethers. And it was as it was dragging across, it was, you know, it was busting power lines along
right,
the way,
right.
And there's some
20,000 people lost power.
Yeah, yeah, that's terrible. I mean, I'm laughing about it, but that would be awful if that thing just, you know, raked across the power lines in your area, wouldn't it?
To me, it's just it's funny because it's like a very slow car chase.
Well, that's what it amounted to. But the thing is, like this produced some really incredible photographs. If you want to look at photographs from, you know. People that were in that area on that day, you know, news crews or whatever, because they were tracking this thing over,
right.
Again, 160 miles, you got a long time when this thing is just floating overhead. So, you remember the most picturesque scenery that we saw on a road rally?
Yes.
In Pennsylvania?
Uh-huh.
Imagine that, you know, with a barn and a nice field with maybe some, you know, like maybe a little bit of fog on the ground there.
Yeah.
And then above that is this crazy-looking blimp floating at some odd angle, dragging its tethers across the forest that's nearby. It's just a weird look. And, of course, surrounded by police cars. You know, there's a lot of shots that have 10 or 12 police cars as they try to get from road to road and follow this thing. Here's one of the photos, Ben, I'm going to show you, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. And there are things like Amish buggies, you know, in the foreground with this just kind of floating aimlessly behind it. So it made huge headlines in the area, and of course it caused a lot of damage. And the military was pretty embarrassed about it.
Right. The program was very, very close to being canceled, so...
Oh.
And
yeah.
this iteration of Airship could have also gone the way of the Dodo or the Hindenburg. However, military sat down with Raytheon, I imagine, talked about J-Lins, and they worked out their concerns. They figured out what happened,
mm-hmm.
which was this: there was a malfunctioning pressure sensing device, and it caused a loss of air pressure in the tail fins, leading to a loss of aerodynamic efficiency, and combined with the wind drag, that exacerbated the tension on the tether and caused it to break.
And there was one other critical point here, is that there was a little bit of human error that was thrown into this mix as well.
Mm.
So what happened was there was supposed to be a system that would automatically deflate this thing if something like what happened, if it broke the tether. If it recognized that the tether is broken, there's an electronic feature that would automatically deflate it. And so once, you know, before it ever got miles away from its mooring, it should have deflated. The problem was, you know, the human that was supposed to put the batteries in the system forgot to put the batteries in.
Oh.
And that was the problem. So, it led to some downed trees in Pennsylvania and some power lines, as we heard. And, you know, of course, facepalm moment for the military, and I guess, well, for NORAD too. I mean, that's the North American Aerospace Defense Command.
Yes, and they had to monitor it the way that they monitor Santa Claus every year.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose everybody was kind of like, oh man, this is just a black eye on the program. However, I think that they have said that they are going to fund this program.
Exactly,
they're going to add some money to the because they realize the benefit in it as well. Everybody makes mistakes, right?
And they worked it out. Together, you know, Raytheon, the J-Lens team, and the military did the calculations, and they said, okay, yes, this was a huge embarrassment, but the ability to sense cruise missile technology at this level is worth the investment and, you know, omelet, broken eggs.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. They've already invested, you know, at this point when it broke free, they had already, you know, invested something like $2.7 billion into this J-Lens program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they said, well, here, we're going to continue to fund this because we know we're close to making this work. We're going to give you another $27 million to kind of reboot these operational exercises that are happening at the Aberdeen facility. And so it all works out in the end, I guess, but they have been cleared to fly again, so
right.
The program is underway once again. But what a system this is, because if they can get this to work, and the idea to have it where it is right now, they're trying to test it in an area where they can say, and of course there's backups right now because it is it's a concept right now, really. I mean, it's still
right.
At this point even. But they're trying to, as you said, Ben, they're trying to track cruise missiles or drones or any other threats that might enter the nation's capital area.
Yeah.
And that can then be extrapolated to work for the rest of the nation. So they can put this on the coast. They can put this wherever they want, you know, as many mm-hmm. places they want. But with that 360-degree, 340-mile... in all directions view.
Right.
That's a pretty significant system. I mean, if it's as good at, you know, sensing these things as they say it is, it's a great defense system.
And again, these are entirely defense systems as far as we know. These are surveillance systems that will communicate with a system that has an offensive capacity if necessary.
Yeah, something or someone that can take action.
Right.
This is really just a monitor. It's an eye in the sky.
Right, and these high altitude systems are still, I think, still have the potential to be dangerous. I mean, we'll talk about it in the next part of the show, but there are clear and present and profound privacy concerns that these things force us to consider.
Yeah, and those will come up a little bit more in focus, I guess, maybe, right after a word from our sponsor.
And we have returned. Scott, at the opening here, or right before we went to break, rather, we mentioned the privacy concerns. I want to step back just a little bit to establish something that I did not mention earlier. So we talked about the JLens program. Mm-hmm. However, the JLens program is not the only show in town. Israel also has a system, and it is the Aeronautics Defense SkyStar 300. This system is the same thing. It's an ISR system, intelligence, surveillance, target acquisition, reconnaissance. Again, no offensive capacity, you know. Mm-hmm. This is just surveilling and monitoring. And it's been, it's an unmanned aerial vehicle. So it's been pretty successful in Israel. The Mexican government signed a deal to get one for the Mexican Federal Police. Hmm. So this technology is being sold and spreading.
Not a bad idea.
But we know that in most cases, these are being used, I guess the best way to say it would be like by state-level actors confronting, you know, state-level threats, military stuff. But we know that the surveillance blimps are not just relegated to the world of the military now, right?
No, in fact, we've taken this this military application and used it in for very civilian use, I suppose. Still, you know, it's still police use, of course, but it's but it is being used in a more everyday practical way, I guess, for other things. And one of those is something that we witnessed in Rio back in 2016. For the Olympics, of course, the Summer Olympics were held there, and this is a technology that was created by a company called Logos Technologies, L-O-G-O-S Technologies, and the system itself is called Cimera. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, S-I-M-E-R-A. And the way the system works is it's actually a series of four balloons that were requested, you know, by the, I don't know if it's the Olympic Committee or the city itself that requested this for protection or what, but it's what they call is an unprecedented level of security for the Olympics. And the way it works is that there are four balloons, again, that hovered above the city with a camera. As
yeah.
simple as that, right? Now, these cameras are pretty sophisticated. We'll get to what those offer in just a moment. But the guy that's in charge of this, his name is John Marion, and he's the president of Logos. And he's quoted as saying that, "We create a Google Earth view of the city and update it every single second. So we store every single thing that we capture on the camera, and we can go through it like TiVo, so they can back it up, they can watch it whenever they want. But that's not the best part of this thing. Cimera, the system, again, called Cimera, combines a wide-angle view with the ability to zoom in on any point at will. The operator can open up as many zoom windows as necessary to follow events on the ground, with enough detail to track vehicles and people while still getting the big picture from its 13 cameras. So I think that's just, I think what they're saying is one balloon is carrying 13 cameras,
so
I believe. And now they're four times that, watching the city.
So it's also the ultimate extension of picture-in-a-picture technology. Do you remember that, how that used to be a big deal with TVs?
Yeah, I do. And I've had that on every television since, and I don't think I ever use it, ever.
You know, I honestly don't know I have honestly never checked if my television can do that.
You know, before, or when that became a thing,
uh-huh.
I had a friend, he's a funny guy, it was the old televisions, you know, the big boxy ones, tube TVs.
Yeah.
He had two TVs that he'd stack on top of each other, and he called it picture on picture. And he would have two different stations going, like two, you know, baseball games or whatever it was, you know.
Uh-huh.
Picture on picture. I thought it was clever.
I think that's a good idea.
I guess. That got really heavy, though. You know, like it'd have to be the smaller TV on top, like a stack, but.
Well, you got to put some thought into something.
I guess.
It's worth doing.
Okay, anyways, back to the main story here. It says, this guy goes on to say that although it captures gigabytes of data every single second, the operator only has to see a tiny fraction of it. So they're looking. The person who's monitoring whatever's happening is seeing about 1/10,000th of what's available on the screen at the time. So it's hard to really picture this, maybe, but there's this enormous picture. Like, picture it the size of your wall.
Okay.
And that's an extremely high definition. You can zoom into any point of that you want and watch. You can identify a person, you know, from whatever altitude this is, 10,000 feet or whatever.
Yeah.
You can then zoom into that tiny little corner, but everything else in that picture continues to record. So you can then later go back and zoom in on something that's completely on the other side of town and watch what's going on there. You can track people with this. It's really remarkable. So, you know, a human can only watch one area at a time, but since everything is stored, it's this invaluable forensic evidence, I guess, that's left over behind, that you're able to just use this footage for whatever you want. Now, the thing that probably the craziest thing about this is you would think it would be this enormous setup, right? The reality is it's about 40 pounds. That's how much the instruments weigh. So getting it up in the air is really not an issue at all. It's 40 pounds of weight to get the Samara system. And they were able to monitor the entire city of Rio during the 2016 Olympics using this system.
How did it pan out?
I guess it worked fine. I mean, we didn't hear of any incidents because, well, there was some real concern over, IEDs and things like that, right. And, terrorist attacks and
which
all that.
An improvised explosive
device. Yeah, and... You know, the thing is, he had another version of this, and this is, you know, again, this is like the evolution of the system, I suppose. WAMI, which is WAMI, which stands for Wide Area Motion Imagery, isn't anything new. In fact, this guy has been working on something called Constant Hawk for a long time at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and he had trouble, you know, finding people that would support his idea up until this point, you know, when he finally got it kind of out into the public. And he said he spent a lot of time going around Washington saying that, you know, here's why you need this and why. And it wasn't until, this type of threat that we talked about, you know, like the threat that we were thinking of for the Olympics that might have happened, no one really paid attention. His example, I guess, maybe for this one, he said, you know, the way I could really sell this to, you know, the Olympic Committee was say, let's just say that, you know, there was a bombing. You know, something happened there in the city of Rio. It doesn't matter where, you know, what venue or anywhere. The analysts could go backwards in the footage and see where the car came from and where the driver went afterwards. So if there was one of these improvised explosive devices, they could spot the people that actually laid this bomb out, you know, exactly when and where they did it or how they did it. And then they could also figure out who is the trigger man for the device, because that's going to be the person that's casually walking away from the bombing, and that's easy to spot on this thing because you've got this enormous view. So it's an incredible thing. But you know, being able to track somebody, you know, forward and backward in time, you can use this technology to locate safe houses, you know, of insurgents or you know anything that you want. You could just track just about anything and see license plates. You can see faces of people. It's clear enough to identify somebody. And of course, you know, we don't know if that can be used in, you know, court of law or anything right now, but I bet we'll find that out in the near future, in the next couple of years probably.
And we're also going to find out about other types of airship applications for surveillance. Here's something that we should mention is we've already said that these are by far not the only game in town. The United Kingdom is working on its own version, and you'll see stuff like the Dragon Dream, which is an elliptical, lighter-than-air ship, currently in a manufacturing process or limbo. They built a prototype and a half-scale proof of concept. Mm-hmm. Airships are going to be a big deal because in many ways they have a versatility in terms of payload that a lot of other aircraft would not have.
How so?
I'm glad you asked. Well, take the HAV-304, the Airlander 10. The Airlander 10, which is a UK project, has a mix of payloads. So they can put in ground moving target indication radar, sort of like what was happening at Rio. They can also do infrared sensors, electro-optical sensors, so detecting electrical activity, blue force tracking, signals intelligence, electronic countermeasures, which is a little bit closer to something effective or something like slightly offensive, because that's essentially a way to trick or deceive radar.
Now, this is something that John Marion was describing as, I think he called it smart surveillance cameras or smart surveillance software, maybe, because the cameras that I was talking about sound similar in the way that you're talking about or you're describing, in that they help you spot the bad guys, because there are certain actions they take that are noted, that are, you know, known to law enforcement. They say, you know, here, you know, this guy's lingering in this area a little bit too long.
Right.
This vehicle's moving in, this fashion, and we know that that's typical of somebody who is doing, you know, this, is involved in this activity. So it's really interesting how they can identify potentially suspicious behaviors by just kind of, flagging these known behaviors and then looking for that in this enormous picture. And they're able to find it. They really are able to find it. And it's clever. It's so clever. And they've, well, that's probably an obvious statement, but, they found also with these cameras, and I don't know if this is the same with the one that you're describing, but they found that there's an optimum number of pixels for the correct resolution. You would think it would be, you know, billions. The more pixels, the more
sure.
better, right?
Yeah.
But that's not the case. They found that there's kind of a sweet spot with several million pixels. They won't tell you exactly, you know, what the resolution is.
Right.
But billions is not as good as millions in this case. And you would think that that would be the opposite. You think you'd always want more in that situation. But another use, Ben, and if I'm not going too far away from what you're
sure,
talking
sure.
about, is that police think that they can use this for capturing people that are involved in, like, high-speed chases and things like that. You know, like when, so have you ever seen, like, maybe an episode of Cops or something like
oh,
that?
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
or you read about this in the paper or whatever, but let's say the car stops and four or six people jump out of a car, you know, they're involved in some, let's say a bank theft or something.
And scattered to the winds.
Yeah, they go everywhere, right? And sometimes they catch everybody, sometimes mm-hmm. you know, one or two get away, sometimes all of them get away. In this situation, if you had one of these systems monitoring this, you'd be able to catch all six almost immediately, because it can coordinate, you know, with the ground effort in order to capture them in real time. It's not something they have to watch, you know, watch it taped. They can, if they're monitoring this, it can happen right then. It can happen in real time.
So this leads us to, as we said, the larger concerns. This type of aircraft can be a tremendous asset when it comes to security, right? And being able to monitor threats and hopefully prevent them from occurring.
Oh, right? Sure, it's an incredible tool.
However, like any other technology, it can have its dark side as well.
Yeah.
And privacy advocates are very concerned that these airships and other similar craft could be used to track individuals by generating radar geolocation data and correlating it with stuff like traffic cameras or cell phone metadata.
Mm-hmm.
And a spokesperson for the Army, at least in the case of JLens, said it will not have video cameras, nor will it collect personally identifiable information.
Oh, okay, so that one's just a radar.
That was just like, yeah,
that's a radar
missile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, and it says primary mission is to track airborne objects, secondary to track surface moving objects such as vehicles or boats. It can't track individual people.
You know what this vaguely reminds me of?
1984.
The cameras that were first installed at intersections where they claimed they were just a blind camera that would just count like a blip on the screen, like just for traffic monitoring reasons to,
right.
to determine how many vehicles were going through an intersection. It wasn't so much to catch somebody running a red light, because those we know are video cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But the early ones, people were so worried about those, that they were, you know, watching whatever they're doing in the car from above, when really it was just simply a just like a counter, really. It was just counting like one blip, two blips, three blips.
Yeah, it was an automation of, this is something you may have seen, folks, if you're not very young, you know, I am old enough to remember the civil engineers who would sit at intersections with the little clickers.
In a lawn chair.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
And just count the cars.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't know it was that guy's job. I thought he was just weird.
He just has some kind of OCD problem. He's just hanging out there counting cars, like only blue cars.
Yeah, only blue cars.
Yeah,
of course. Red cars are for the
birds. But you see where it progressed to. It did progress to what the people had feared, that it was good, that it progressed to the video cameras that were then, yes, watching what you're doing, but, you know, okay, so it's mainly for license plates and running red lights. But
sure.
Can I just point out one more quick thing?
Yeah,
I know
yeah,
this
yeah.
is rambling now
yeah,
at this
no,
point,
please.
But do you know that we talked about that I-85 fire and the bridge collapse?
Uh-huh.
I heard something a little bit startling on the news the other day about this.
What's that?
They said that, and I had a hard time understanding. I'm going to have to look this up and double check, but
okay.
I think I heard that fire damaged 30 cameras that are used by the Atlanta police.
Now, 30 cameras.
Now, okay, that's what I thought. Now, you had the same reaction that I have. It's not a huge area. It's a big section of bridge, like maybe, what? I think they're going to replace something like 700 feet of bridge. It's a big area. I mean, as far as like a bridge goes.
30 cameras, though.
Well, that's what I heard. Now, do you think the number was 13 and I heard 30? Or, I mean, even so, 13 cameras in that area? But I think I heard 30 cameras.
Yeah, I want to check into that. And we know they're around, but we don't know where and what they focus
and
on.
I wonder if that also has to do with, you know, if they're maybe they're fiber optic or something, and you know, if you know the line is severed, then you have to, you know, replace the line that goes to all of them or something like that. So maybe it's more about the connection and not the actual hardware itself. But
I could see there being cameras there because that bridge was a storage space in violation of code, by the way.
Yeah, sure. Well,
for a lot of equipment.
Okay, but okay. Again, we're way off topic. I'm sorry, but the number was astounding, and I'm gonna, you know, check that again when we leave the podcast today.
And would a blimp have helped?
So
because it's under the bridge.
So I'm sorry, I've thrown us off track here, but you're talking about the main question that I had at the very end of this podcast, and if you got more to add, please do, Ben. But the main question I guess we have for our listeners and for I suppose you and I, we can think about this.
Sure.
Maybe it comes down to security versus privacy, right? You want to be secure, you want people to monitor what's going on, you want them to protect you, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But how much are you willing to give up in your privacy? How much are you willing to give up in your private life to have that kind of protection, you know, somebody watching over your
right.
shoulder to say, yeah, you're okay, but then again there's somebody watching over your shoulder.
And here's another problem. Can you, and this is open, it's open to anyone, folks, can you name a time that the U.S. government has had the capability to collect more information, require more power, and stepped away from it for ethical concerns?
Now, I see.
A single time.
Now, usually it's a progressive thing where it steps up a little bit and up mm-hmm. a little bit more, and then
what salesmen call the foot in the door strategy.
Yeah, there's an incident of some kind. They say, "Well, we need to do this right now, so let's pass legislation that allows us to do that, whatever it is." And it just gets a little bit more invasive as time goes on.
And as we've talked about in previous episodes, another thing that is frequently true is this: technology, the evolution of technology, typically outpaces the evolution of legislation.
Yeah.
We make laws after we figure out what our new toys can do.
Yeah, what it's capable of, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
And just hope it doesn't fall into the wrong hands prior to that happening. But then again, if it's going to happen, legislation is not going to stop it from happening.
Scott, can you imagine? Are we looking at a future filled with evil blimp tycoons and masterminds?
Yeah, people that know everything about everyone, but they own 100 Zeppelins.
I still want to ride one so much.
Crazy.
So this concludes our episode, our exploration on the future of airships.
Yeah, and I mean, fine if they're being used for protection, right? I mean, but
sure.
But what point do we decide that? Yeah, maybe it's a little bit too invasive for us. So that's the question we have for you. You know, the security versus privacy thing. Write in and tell us if you think that, you know, the blimps have gone too far. We've gone too far. You know, progress is fine, but you know, enough is enough.
Is this a legitimate concern or is it a bunch of hot air?
I like it.
So bad.
Is that the first time we've used that?
That we got so far through this podcast without doing a hot air joke.
I said something about in focus.
In focus,
yeah,
did.
There was that.
That was good. Yes, let's grade each other's.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess
there's jokes off.
You know,
air.
There should have been way more puns in this episode.
Yeah,
there really should have been.
Ah, shit, we missed it. Can we get away with that one?
That was probably the best one.
That was terrible. Write in and let us know some better airship puns, because obviously we could use the help. And we have to do one more thing. We needed to give people some nicknames. You had Shift and Tristan. Let's go with Dylan Hot Air Fagan.
Dirigible.
Dylan Dirigible Fagan.
Oh, Dirigible. Did I mispronounce it? Zeppelin? No, it doesn't rhyme, though.
I like Dylan Dirigible.
I like the alliterative nature of that one.
Yeah, that's nice.
Dirigible.
And
I'll get it right next time.
Yes. Yeah. All right, our next airship episode. Or maybe we can just call him Dirigible around the office.
And why not?
So let us know what you think about the rise of these surveillance aircraft. And are they overall a good thing or a bad thing? As we have said in previous episodes, are you for it or against it?
I got one more. Tristan, the all-seeing eye.
Oh, Wow, that's pretty good.
I don't know. That's pretty long. I mean, you can't really put that on a jersey, you know?
He's laughing. I think he's got a jersey that he can fit it on. Or no, he should get a blimp, and you can put the name on the blimp.
Of course. Why didn't I think of that?
Blimps are now my solution to every life problem.
Yeah. You know, you can buy an RC blimp pretty easy.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
Well, they fly them over, you know, like in sporting events in the arenas, and they drop things with, you know, the little servo motors, coupons or, you know, in whatever. I mean, souvenirs of some kind for the team.
I want to be in the blimp. I used to want to live in an RV, and now I want to live in a blimp.
Live in a blimp, really?
Yeah.
Wasn't even in the movie... Okay, we're getting way off topic again. We should wrap this up. You ever watch the movie Up?
I have not seen it.
Isn't there an evil character that lives in the Zeppelin?
Well, then I have found a role model, and I will watch Up.
I think there is. Yeah, you should.
I hear the first 10 minutes of that are really sad.
Yeah, you can skip that if you don't want to.
Just go 15 minutes in?
Yeah, then it's a happier movie.
So... We are heading off. We will be back next week with a brand new episode. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. You can also write to us directly if you have ideas for something you think your fellow listeners would like to learn more about, or if you happen to be a blimp tycoon. Well-meaning or ill-intentioned? That's fine. I'm just into this blimp tycoon thing. Write to us directly. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.